Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 13th day of March, 2021. I'm your host, Mark Call. And as I took a look back over the week that was and thought about the order and the theme, if there was one for today, that tied them together, and especially since here in the Rockies, we're starting to get some pretty warm days, warm enough at least to melt a whole bunch of snow, so yeah, it's also called mud season, but it certainly means that spring is near, and that along with the stories had me thinking back to an old musical entitled Springtime for Hitler. Alright, if you know the rest of the story, it was a fictional musical and a song to go with it from a 1967 film by Mel Brooks called The Producers. The plot device has to do with a crooked producer and his accountant who decide to raise a whole lot of money by defrauding investors in a Broadway play that they designed to fail. They oversell the potential return on the play by 25,000%, and once it's failed, they get to keep the profits. Nowadays, it's called rehypothecation if you have the right political connections. It's just fine, especially in the paper gold and silver markets. But I guess the main difference between the producers and the crooked casinos is that in the case of the Mel Brooks film, the producers did everything they could up front to make sure that the play was a total flop and they'd get their money quickly. And really, folks, can you think of a much more tasteless script to use for the vehicle than something called Springtime for Hitler, a gay romp with Adolf and Eva at Birch's Garden? In the movie, it was described as practically a love letter to Adolf Hitler. He then hires the worst director he can find, a stereotypical homosexual and transvestite caricature, and casts an out-of-control hippie named Lorenzo St. Dubois, also known by his initials as LSD, in the title role of Adolf. And if you're starting to see why your host might see some parallels with Springtime for Hitler and Springtime for America 2021, you're probably right on track. With the title role played by a senile hair sniffer, after making his bones as one of the biggest criminal mob bosses in the formerly free United States, obviously, though, this guy can't sing. And in the case of Springtime for Biden, it's an entire totalitarian regime staffed by stereotypical homosexuals and transgender caricatures of politically correct perversions run amok. And if you haven't seen it, the title sequence really resonates today. Here's how it begins.
Germany was having trouble, what a sad, sad story. Needed a new leader to restore its former glory. Where, oh, where was he?
Where could that man be?
We looked around, and then we found a man for you and me. And now it's
springtime for Hitler and Germany. Deutschland is happy and gay.
We're marching to a faster pace. Look out, here comes the master race. Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
All right, well, the parallels are obvious, and certainly for those that understand anything about history, downright undeniable. From fascism as a political and economic tool of totalitarianism, ever so effective today, to the massive in-your-face degeneracy and moral decay, to the political correctness of the one and only party. There's a degree of blindness, too, that doesn't fit precisely but certainly rhymes. For example, outright racism is now called tolerance. But it's still okay to hate those people. Today it's not just Jews, it's anybody that looks white. And since so many of them don't have a clue what fascism really is, they prefer to call themselves anti-fascists. Better still, of course, progressives. Oh, and let's not forget, for all his faults, Adolf Hitler was actually able to give a cogent and crowd-inspiring speech. No earwigs, teleprompters, or obvious puppet strings. And finally, Hitler wanted a strong military, whereas the Biden-Führer is looking to totally destroy the United States military so that his communist Chinese masters can come in and do as they like with the plunder. Which does, in fact, lead me to our first story today, where the senile one actually does, in fact, forget what that thing with five sides is called, you know, the Pentagon, and the guy that's supposed to be, more or less, the head of what's left of the American military, the Secretary of Defense. What's his name? Oh, yeah, Lloyd Austin. But not to worry, they forgot about the defense part a long time ago. Here's the Marionette-in-Chief announcing the nomination of two female generals to lead U.S. military combatant commands.
I just want to thank you both, and I want to thank the former general. I keep calling him general, but the guy who runs that outfit over there. I want to make sure we thank the secretary for all he's done to try to implement what we've just talked about.
What they're talking about, of course, is gutting the military. And besides destroying unit cohesion, which has pretty much been a done deal for a while now, and let's not forget the poke, but too many haven't been dumbed down enough yet, so a lot of military are actually refusing that. Good for them. How are they continuing that process?
Some of it's relatively straightforward work, where we're making good progress designing body armor that fits women properly, tailoring combat uniforms for women, creating maternity flight suits.
Whoa, wait a minute. Say what?
Creating maternity flight suits.
You can almost hear the Chinese puppet masters laughing themselves silly as they say, "Hey, let's see if we can make him say this. How about military flight suits for pregnant women? Ha 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 ha! We will bury you! But wait, we won't have to! Biden doing it for us! Ha 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 ha!"
And some of it is going to take an intensity of purpose and mission.
I guess that means we won't stop until the Chinese Communist High Command is right here behind the concertina wire in Swamp Central. Sadly, folks, springtime for Hitler was a farce, and a funny one at that. Springtime for the Biden Fuhrer, on the other hand, is a really sick, downright satanic joke. So let's talk about all that next. Starting with this, courtesy of Zero Hedge. During the annual legislative session in Beijing on Tuesday, President Xi Jinping addressed top leaders of the People's Liberation Army, telling the military it must be, quote, prepared to respond to the increasingly difficult and complex security challenges facing that nation. Quote, "The current security situation of our country is largely unstable and uncertain," said Xi in the address, which came 2 days after Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi gave his own fiery warning to the same assembly, saying the U.S. is, quote, "crossing lines and playing with fire when it comes to Chinese sovereignty over Taiwan." Understand one thing, folks, the Biden Fuhrer puppet will back down, as per plan, and as we go through these next few stories, we'll see how those pieces are falling into place. Continued President Xi, "the entire military must coordinate the relationship between capacity building and combat readiness, be prepared to respond to a variety of complex and difficult situations at any time, resolutely safeguard national sovereignty," theirs, of course, not the United States, "security and development interests, and provide strong support for the comprehensive construction of a modern socialist state." That sounds like something Biden could have said if he could have gotten it on the teleprompter now, doesn't it? And Xi, who also serves as the head of the Central Military Commission, further affirmed the need for high-level strategic deterrence and a joint combat system, as well as rapid defense tech innovation. And those words were in agreement with Defense Minister General Wei Feng, who said on Saturday once again that China had entered a, quote, high-risk phase. I hear those words, I gotta admit. Does that mean Xi knows the entire U.S. military isn't quite yet on board with the new regime? Foreign Minister Wang emphasized in a particularly warlike tone the idea of battling a, quote, hegemony, high-handedness, and bullying from the United States and its allies, as well as their, quote, outright interference in China's domestic affairs, unquote. And that's ironic, seeing as how they have their own puppet in the White House now, isn't it? And think of it, folks, if the intent here, and I suggest that it just might be, is to open the borders to invasion, given that that's what we're seeing to the south, and arguably to the communist north as well, wouldn't a new foreign war be just a great way to sidetrack any would-be defenders? Whether the senile codger understands what he's signing or not, that certainly appears to be what the Biden regime's being told to do. Intentional, though, or just idiotic, the diversion is in play. A couple of stories on that front. First from Michael Snyder, emphasizing 9 things that point to the moves that are being made in the Mideast for new war there. Literally one day after Biden was inaugurated, point number 1, a massive U.S. military convoy rolled into Syria. Even though Trump had tried very hard to disengage from war there, the Biden Fuhrers made it crystal clear the U.S. will be heavily involved going forward. Just a few weeks later, as you probably recall, the Marionette-in-Chief rubber-stamped his first airstrike against Iranian-backed forces inside Syria, where at least 22 fatalities were reported there. That was followed up by an inevitable response from Iranian-backed forces, who retaliated by launching rockets at a U.S. military base in Iraq. And just a couple of days ago, the so-called defense secretary, Biden couldn't remember his name anyway, said there will be a U.S. military response, quote, at a time and place of our own choosing. And in fact, number four, notes Michael Snyder, U.S. airstrikes may come sooner rather than later because reports say the U.S. has just sent six B-52 bombers to Diego Garcia and approximately 10,000 more troops to the Middle East, according to a Wall Street Journal article. Russia has been making moves in the region as well. Number six, on Friday, Russia conducted an airstrike at an oil loading facility in Syria used by opposition forces backed by Turkey, as well as Saudi Arabia and, of course, the Biden regime. Meanwhile, Israel, too, number seven, continues to hit strategically important targets inside Syria on a regular basis. And in particular, they seem to have told acting President Kamala Harris that Israel intends to stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons, and that means they're willing to do whatever it takes. Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz, though, told Fox News in a recent interview that Israel is ready to attack Iran with or without any U.S. help. Finally, continues Michael Snyder, we're being told this week that the Biden regime is quite eager to make the Russians pay for that so-called solar winds hack first reported back in December. Some, though, suggest it might have been China all along. And, as usual, it's Russia that takes the blame because it's China that wants us to go to war with them. It really does, though, seem to have been China that did the Microsoft Exchange server hack, seizing control over hundreds of thousands of Microsoft email servers worldwide over the weekend. Nevertheless, the New York Times claims the Biden regime is getting ready to initiate a series of so-called clandestine cyber attacks that will seriously hurt Russia. But how secret can they really be if the New York Times is telegraphing the move? Notes Snyder, a cyber attack is most definitely an act of war, unless, of course, Biden's puppet masters do it, and the Biden regime seems to be taking the United States down a path that could ultimately lead to military conflict with Russia, and almost certainly a wider conflict in the Middle East. While the Chinese puppet masters, of course, sit back and clap their hands with glee. No doubt planning on divvying up some of the choicest properties in California, along with maybe some mountain estates in, say, Montana. Thanks to former Nevada Senator Dirty Harry, they already have plenty of solar properties in the Southwest. We certainly don't want to forget the economic warfare component either, or the meltdown already in progress. Two quick headlines there. Goldman Sachs, the vampire squid, has done the SLR, or statutory liquidity reserve math, says Zero Hedge, and with overstressed banks facing as much as $2 trillion in reserve limitations should SLR not be extended, the U.S., they note, could be weeks away from negative interest rates. And analyst Michael Every of Rabobank writes, don't look now, but even the Chinese currency is slowly starting to move. It's broken through its 100-day moving average at 6.5282 after sliding 0.6% last week. The horror, the horror. And that's despite a 60.6% year-over-year increase in exports. To repeat, he says, the Feds are on blackout. And here's what he means by that. Do you think U.S. yields can't move higher than this, moving other things along with them? As Bloomberg has noted today, pure economic forecasts, back when we had them, suggest that U.S. GDP growth will briefly hit an alleged high, your host put that word in there, of 7.6%. Yeah, sure, due to the sugary Biden stimulus. And on top of that, the gap between U.S. nominal GDP and the U.S. 10-year will be the widest since 1966. Risks, though, must be near-term that yields rise to meet nominal growth, even if the longer-term, and perhaps not even that long, its growth will come down and, again, take bonds with it. So, what do the Feds have to say in the face of all of this? That's right, nothing. They are on blackout. Folks, push is coming to shove, and the inevitable boils down to this. Nobody wants U.S. 10-year Treasury notes. They're calling them certificates of guaranteed confiscation because they pay less than what the obvious inflation rate is going to be looking forward about as far as anybody with eyes can see. Interest rates have basically been at zero for a long time. They may go lower, but hey, can they really do that? Still, since Big Brother's obviously printing money like there's no tomorrow, and indeed there may not be, wouldn't you think that inflation is pretty well baked in the cake, and the Fed, if they're halfway responsible, would have to raise rates? Oh, but wait, they can't, because then the entire bubble would immediately pop, and we can't have that now, can we? But ooh, deflationary depression kind of gets a bad rap too now, doesn't it? Well, yeah, something's eventually going to have to pop, and no doubt the globalists will decide the best thing to do is just wipe the slate clean, get rid of the almighty fiat dollar, and try some kind of a, I don't know, great reset. Might be helpful if we had a world war, too, to make sure nobody resists that. By the way, if you've been paying attention over the last few days, you might have noticed that you could have bought the real precious metals, gold and especially silver, for less at least than it has been for the last month or so. Still, though, there was a bit of a reversal during the week, even in the paper gold and silver markets, and the chances to do so may be coming to an end. And before we move on from economics and, of course, economic fascism and springtime for Biden, there's this story from Gab CEO Andrew Torba, who revealed on Monday just how badly the regime wants to attack any pro-speech forum that is an alternative to Facebook and Twitter. Referring to an Obama regime ploy called Operation Choke Point, he said, yes, it's back under Biden, and just like firearms dealers and other deplorables were targeted for financial blacklisting that time around, now the list has expanded. Quote, four banks and one credit card have shut down Gab in the past month alone, said CEO Torba. We've spoken to other tech platforms who are experiencing the same, but have not gone public with it yet. This, he wrote, is 100% targeted and political. And that, folks, is the real power and danger of fascism, or the public-private partnership. Big Brother essentially manipulates the system and says, hey, you might be able to start a business, but ha-ha, you can't really if you can't finance it. Says Andrew Torba, it's getting to the point where we're seriously considering buying our own bank. I'm not kidding. Which inclines your host to suggest, gee, what do you bet there just might be a new executive order show up on the puppetmeister's desk for a signature, if that looks like it might happen. So let's do a story or two next that tell us things we already knew. But it's the fact that they're now admitting that tells us a whole lot more. For example, just as last weekend began, the CDC released a report in which it quietly admitted that the mask mandates in America were allegedly responsible, even if you believe their bogus numbers, for less than a 2% decrease in COVID case growth after a full 100 days. No, not 2 weeks to flatten the curve. But still, the CDC advises wearing, well, maybe one, maybe a whole bunch of masks, despite their own numbers. Forget fall of the science, folks. It's fall of the lemmings. Now, though, they're claiming that between March 1 and December 31st of last year, 2020, the unconstitutional totalitarian mask mandates executed in what they admitted were the vast majority of U.S. counties allegedly stopped the COVID case growth rates by 0.5% after 20 days and by less than 2% after 100 days. Ultimately, not statistically significant. Now, bear in mind, folks, that most of the damage from mask wearing occurs longer term. Things like mask knee and bacterial pneumonia that only show up after extended periods. Likewise, damage to your immune system, which may go on for a while before the effects are obvious. So, arguably, the long-term harm from mask wearing, even if it turns out to be very statistically significant, may be able to be suppressed for a while longer. And that, of course, doesn't even count the damnable sociological and psychological consequences, which will be felt for years. Let's call this a supporting point from Ethan Huff at Natural News. And no, not the CDC, because they're going to continue to lie about this one. New research has determined that a person with gum disease who tests positive, whether it's a real positive or a fake one, for the Wuhan COVID-1984 coronavirus is 9 times more likely to die from the disease than a positive case that doesn't have the mask-induced gum disease. Published in the Journal of Clinical Periodontology, the case study determined that patients with gum disease showed blood markers of inflammation throughout their bodies, which could be the cause. Quote, the results of the study suggest that inflammation in the oral cavity may open the door to the coronavirus becoming more violent, said study co-author Professor Lior Shapira of Hebrew University in Israel. Oral care should be part of the health recommendations to reduce the risk for severe COVID-19 outcomes, said the president-elect of the European Federation of Periodontology as well. And I'll say it again, folks, based on studies like this, what do you bet that the worst problems associated with extended mask wearing take longer than 100 days to develop? And back during the summer, notes the Natural News piece, it was revealed that persistent mask wearing is becoming a leading cause of gum disease. First, it was two dentists from Manhattan that came forward to say they were seeing hordes of new patients that did not have issues before with gum disease, all of them forced to wear masks on a regular basis. Professor Mariano Sanz of the Complutense Universidad of Madrid in Spain said that such mask wearing, quote, may contribute to the deterioration of patients with COVID-19 and raise the risk of death because, he added, oral bacteria, which festers inside people's masks all day long, is easily inhaled, allowing it to infect the lungs and cause serious health problems. Quote, hospital staff should identify COVID-19 patients with periodontitis and use oral antiseptics to reduce transmission of bacteria. Because gum disease affects a whole lot of people worldwide and left untreated, it can spread throughout the body, resulting in eventual death. From any number of other complications, including asthma, pneumonia, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, and wearing a mask further exacerbates the risk of developing any or all of those complications. So if you're actually concerned about your health, start by losing the damnable face muzzle. And of course, in the process, help by strengthening your immune system. And avoid those other things that Big Brother's going to push that do the exact opposite. Oh, yeah, like the mRNA-based gene therapy masquerading as a vaccine. This next item came out over the weekend from actor, comedian, writer, and lawyer Ben Stein, who took the coronavirus poke and had a really tough time for quite a few days afterwards. Here's his advice.
A word of warning to you, my fellow Americans, or whatever you are. I had the COVID booster, the Moderna, about 4 or 5 days ago, and I am still feeling wild side effects from it. Like I had the worst flu in the world, extreme shortness of breath, a dizziness, fatigue, extremely irrational thinking. It has just been devastating. I'm glad I got it. Sort of glad. I don't know, a little bit glad and also not quite so glad. But it has just got to be told to the people, us people, that this booster is a killer. I mean, it's not going to kill you literally, but it is very, very strong. Beware.
So I'm really sorry I took it. Well, I'm not super sorry, but I do think you need to be warned because maybe I wouldn't do it again, and it's probably not going to kill you, but, well, maybe it might. There's an obvious message in there somewhere, folks, and I can't help but think that for those that haven't been properly propagandized, it should be painfully obvious. And by the way, that doesn't include the long-term effects, right, Ben? After all, that's what guinea pigs are for. Next item. And so it begins, says Brian Shilhavy, editor of Health Impact News. Those of us who have been exposing the corruption in Big Pharma, and especially the vaccine industry, knew this day was coming. And the COVID pandemic has now shifted medical tyranny into high gear, all in the name of public safety. Because now they're being called domestic terrorists. What does that mean? No, not the people who are pushing poison. That's the new label for those who dare to question the new experimental COVID-1984 injections. Yeah, folks, that's the Zyklon B poke. And if you're looking for somebody to run that new propaganda campaign, remember, Dr. Mengele, a.k.a. Tony Fauci's already taken. Who else would you pick but California Senator Dr. Sick Richard Pan, the pediatrician turned politician who spearheaded California's descent into medical tyranny since 2015 when he wrote SB 277 to remove all religious exemptions to any childhood vaccines in the state of California. He's got a long history as a liar and whore for Big Pharma, and now he's the guy they've picked to start the domestic terrorist campaign against any who dare to refuse the soon-to-be-mandated poke. So it shouldn't surprise anyone to learn that an opinion piece published in Jeff Bezos' WAPO entitled Anti-Vaccine Extremism is Akin to Domestic Terrorism was penned by none other than California Big Pharma spokes-tyrant Richard Pan. Notes Health Impact News, prevaricator Pan has a long history of selling out his constituents to Big Pharma, and now he says taking your poison poke is a, quote, patriotic act, and so is speaking up to support public health efforts. So let's not allow extremism, division, or fear to slow the efforts to do what they intend to do to you, one way or another. So now you know why they want you disarmed, too. We certainly got a whole lot more to talk about this evening, and we'll pick it up approximately right there after the bottom of the hour break. Stay with us. Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. I'm your host, Mark Call, and I want to start off this one with what I think is the biggest story in the latter part of the week. This totalitarian abomination hasn't yet passed the Senate, but you do have to wonder if that no longer makes any difference anyway. But it shows you how communist the House is. And I'll try to hold back any furious commentary until I get the story out, but this is about the universal background check. It's got other names. I call it the end of private property in communist America. But this is basically a bill that says, look, we don't give a blankety-blank-and-you-know-what about that shall-not-be-infringed thing. But we have passed a requirement that all of you slaves must have permission to own, to buy, transfer, keep, sell, loan, or even destroy what was once called private property. Now, if you read the law books, they will say, if you own it, you can do anything you want with it. Buy, sell, loan, disassemble, modify, give away, ruin it. If you want, it's yours. The House, however, says not for slaves, and they passed a bill 227 to 203 that ends private property. They had eight rhinos sign on board. Only one Democrat had the constitutional fortitude to say, I can't be part of that. And next they go for the rest of it, which of course means all of it. But ultimately, this is probably the most serious anti-constitutional bill, I'll say it, even beyond the Patriot Act and anti-terror acts and other things that have said, oh, we're going to treat the American people as terrorists. Now they're treating them as terrorists and slaves, too. Slaves, of course, cannot own property. Slaves are property. And ask yourself this question. I've mentioned this many times before, but it's never been more important. What single piece of property is the only type of actual property enumerated explicitly in the Constitution about which it is said shall not be infringed? Period. And if you can not only infringe, but demand that the slaves ask masses permission before the slave is allowed to buy, sell, transfer, or loan it, then is there anything about that slave or what he thought was his property that you can't infringe whenever you blankety-blank-and-well feel like it? This bill is the total end of even the pretense of private property in communist America and the right to defend it. And let me put this as kindly as I can. The 227 communists in the House that voted or supported this thing in any way are guilty of treason, which, if you read the Constitution, consists of making war against the states or the people. That's exactly what they have done by trying to disarm their enemies and by destroying everything. I mean, literally, life, liberty, and private property. The whole concept here is being destroyed. It is the fundamental basis of a free society, and it is about as clear of an indication that they've gone completely communist as we will have. And by the way, Fine Swine and the evil Chuck E. Schumer are saying, oh, yo, we're not done yet. We're going to ban them. We're going to take them. And yes, the whole point is, once we get you partially disarmed, we'll kill the rest of you. And we'll finish doing the job of destroying the Republic. They're literally looking for civil war. And on every front, that's no longer being hidden. One obvious example of that is what I've been calling the Zyklon B poke. For the eugenicists, it's better than Hitler's final solution because it avoids the expense of both train rides and concentration camps. People will just line up and do themselves in. People are still dropping dead at rates far in excess of whatever they might have dropped dead had they caught COVID-1984 directly. In the case of really old people, it's 40 to 1 or more. In the case of the younger, it's well over 200 to 1 times more deadly to take the poke than just get the booga-booga flu. A number of nations in Europe now seem to be upset that people are dropping dead from blood clots after taking the poke, and that's over and above what we've already been seeing. But arguably, folks, that's not really news at this point. So let's start our look at what's new on that death front this week, courtesy of First, LeoHolman.com, about Moderna's top scientist. Turns out they've been admitting the uncomfortable truth since before the booga booga flu gave them the opening they needed. Back in 2017, at a TED talk, Dr. Tal Zaks, chief medical officer at Moderna Incorporated, explained how the company's mRNA vaccine, sick, was designed to work. Over the last 30 years, he said, quote, we've been living this phenomenal digital scientific revolution, and I'm here today to tell you that we are actually hacking the software of life, and that's changing the way we think about prevention and treatment of disease. Quick aside here, folks, may also have changed the way some folks think about designing bioweapons, too. He went on to explain that the human body is made up of organs, and organs are made up of cells, and in, quote, every cell there's this thing called messenger RNA, or mRNA for short, that transmits the critical information from the DNA in our genes to the protein, which is really the stuff we're all made out of. This is the critical information that determines what the cell will do. So we think about it as an operating system. And if you could change that, if you could introduce a line of code or change a line of code, it turns out, that has profound implications for everything, from the flu to cancer. Why, here I insert something, folks. You could even re-engineer humans' DNA and play God. What do you bet Adolf Hitler and all the German master race designers are really salivating in their graves now over that? And back on February 4th, as you may recall, there were reports about how Moderna described their new vaccine as, quote, a computer operating system. And no wonder, he said, we're now able to hack the software of life. Imagine, said Zaks back then, if instead of giving a patient the protein of a virus, we gave them the instructions on how to make the protein, how the body can make its own vaccine. And he said it took decades to sequence the human genome, which was actually accomplished back in 2003. Now he said we can do it in a week. And he revealed in 2017 his company's plans to make individual cancer vaccines tailored to the needs of individual cancer patients because, quote, every cancer is different. Which makes it all the more interesting that Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, based in New York, last week reported that the mRNA that they're messing with here has a tendency to inactivate tumor-suppressing proteins, meaning it can promote, not discourage, the growth of cancer cells. And remember, both the Moderna and Pfizer injections are experimental, emphasis on that word, mRNA vaccines. Well, actually, they are gene therapies, folks. Vaccine is a whole different thing. The FDA has only granted these injections emergency use authorization, or EUAs, and they'll remain in trials. So, do you want to be a guinea pig for a trial? Through at least 2023. And that's really not long enough still for long-term effects testing. But the government, media, and corporations are all promoting them as though they were already guaranteed safe. Well, the only thing they're safe for is those that are producing, distributing, and hawking them because they're immune from liability if they kill people. And they are. Writes the author here, this systemic deception will, in his opinion, and in that of many others who are paying attention, end up being judged in the rearview mirror of history as one of the most reckless acts of medical treachery ever committed against the human race. Now, folks, I'd say that's an understatement. If you understand the Nuremberg Protocols, what we're talking about here have pure and simply been described as war crimes now for generations. This is just one of the biggest ever. Oh, and the author makes a good point here, too. If what you're hawking is a DNA-modifying cure for cancer, imagine the possibilities from a purely business point of view if your reckless acts cause a lot more people to get that which you say you can cure. Ain't that convenient? There is, though, more to consider. As Leo Holman points out in the end of the piece, as I listened to Dr. Zaks outline the achievements of his company in creating their mRNA vaccine, I couldn't help but think how incredibly arrogant it all sounds. That scientists believe they can rewrite the genetic code and fix what God got wrong might be called dangerous territory. Who's to say they won't correct one problem and create something else far worse? But Zach wrapped up his 2017 speech with the following words. Quote, if you think about what it is we're trying to do, we've taken information and our understanding of that information, I add this here, folks, limited as it might be. Some of these folks, remember, still use the term junk DNA. Which essentially means they don't know what it does. Back to Zaks, and how that information is transmitted in a cell, and we've taken our understanding of medicine and how to make drugs, and we're fusing the two. We think of it as information therapy, which sounds a whole lot like just nothing but computer software code. These scientists, says Holman, truly believe the human body is nothing more than a machine that can be hacked into and reordered according to some programmer's instructions. While the research might excite some, it certainly horrifies others. Because a person's genetic makeup is, as Dr. Zaks said, the software of life. And if that really is true, then who should have the ultimate authority over each human being's genetic software? Well, if we truly live in a free society, and let's not kid ourselves, no way is that still true. Wouldn't it stand to reason we'd want to have an energetic debate? Well, not in a post-to-Facebook and Twitter world now, can we? To answer that question, shouldn't it be the number one issue debated by the Communist Congress and the Communist media? Oh, yeah, sure. Instead, nobody's allowed to even ask these questions without being threatened, censored, rebuked, deplatformed, and bullied. Members of the corporate media who even dare broach the question get fired. Contrary to what some scientists believe, arguably we're not machines. We're human beings with bodies, souls, and at least once upon a time, free will. And anyone who tries to mandate the acceptance of an experimental gene-altering treatment is definitely violating the international Nuremberg codes, which still require informed consent for any experimental treatment. Dear readers, concludes this story, and I heartily agree, please don't allow your employer, what you might have thought of as your government, a.k.a. Big Brother, your family, your friends, or anyone else, to intimidate or bully you or otherwise even persuade you to accept an experimental treatment if you don't want it. And I'll suggest, folks, that the more you learn about it, the more you won't. Even after all of that, though, I have to admit, sometimes I'm still amazed by people's tendency to ignore the facts in the face of fear and still want to commit suicide. But just maybe this piece, courtesy of Ethan Huff at Natural News, might make a difference to some when nothing else will. Coronavirus vaccine deaths, it says, aren't covered by life insurance because, when it suits them at least, the insurance companies are deciding that the jabs are, quote, experimental medical interventions. So, yeah, before you rush out and take the poke for the booga-booga flu, you just might want to contact your life insurance company and see if they're going to void your policy. And, yeah, folks, we can all hear the shrieking already. And whatever you do, don't try to tweet about it. Reports indicate, says Huff, that people taking the poke could find their coverage voided without them knowing it due to the experimental nature of the EUA under which it was approved. In the event that you die after getting the needle with messenger RNA poison from either Pfizer, BioNTech, or Moderna, many life insurance companies will not pay out because, again, the injections have been deemed, and they are, an experimental medical intervention that has not undergone the normal testing and vetting process. And on this point, you'd have to say, hey, the insurance companies, in spite of the lies, are exactly right. Can't blame them in the least. And yet, here's the rub, folks. You know darn well that if this gets out, and you also know darn well Big Brother's public-private partners will try to make sure it doesn't, there'll be tremendous pressure by and for the insurance companies, and somebody will end up taking a hit. And guess who it's probably going to be, along with the poke. Even a positive coronavirus test, though, continues the piece, might make you ineligible for life insurance coverage, depending upon the carrier. Say reports, some insurers are delaying applications if you are currently testing positive for the booga booga flu and need to provide medical evidence, but that doesn't mean you can't apply again in the future. Questions being asked by insurance carriers now to prospective clients include, have you tested positive for COVID-19? Are you currently in self-isolation? Have you had any symptoms of coronavirus? In other words, have you had a cold? Have you been in direct contact with anyone who's been diagnosed or suspected of having a coronavirus? Now note, folks, it doesn't say the COVID-19 booga booga flu. It says a coronavirus. And yeah, that does include the common cold. Finally, let's connect some dots that might seem to be all over the place, starting with this piece from Bill Sardi about the mask mandates and guidelines and social ostracism and basically how it is that Big Brother lies about the facts and statistically skews the numbers. As I write this brief report, he begins, I think most sane Americans wonder if facts even matter anymore. The FedGov, in league with complicit news media, is driving the stake of fear into the hearts of Americans, using contrived data and a small army of so-called experts who must toe the line if they want to keep their jobs. The hidden objective, and it's really no longer that hidden, is to induce mass fear, coerce Americans to self-poison or vaccinate, and destroy American businesses so the masses will beg for the coming digital currency and mark of the beast control system to replace paper money. Paper currency, really. Coercion to wear face masks to allegedly prevent infectious disease transmission is another exercise in social control, says Sardi, and he's right. And what's behind all of this? Well, the hidden crisis is that the FedGov can no longer maintain its social contract with Americans to pay for things like Social Security and Medicare. It's been obvious for literally decades, folks, that the math simply wasn't going to work and that was going to happen. Well, now we're there. COVID-19, though, serves as a cover for the implosion of the American economy, says Sardi, and just about everybody else who knows what's going on. And remember, there are now only IOUs in the form of U.S. Treasury notes in the Socialist Security and Medicare trust funds. Increased taxes cannot possibly pay for these fiscal shortfalls. And forget about the illegal alien entry bonuses being promised by the Biden regime, much less UBI. Now here, folks, your host will pause and make an observation that literally I've been talking about for decades anyway. When they get to this point, can you think of a better way to solve the fiscal problem than simply managing to kill a whole bunch of old people? Because that way you don't have to pay for Medicare or Social Security. How clever. How easy, given what they've managed to accomplish so far. And they didn't even have to line them up against the wall or send them to a concentration camp. Most lined themselves up and voluntarily took their Zyklon B. Says Bill Sardi, facing imminent insolvency, though, government will come to the rescue and issue electronic so-called money directly from Washington rather than from the Federal Reserve. Americans will need to be monitored in real time when they spend this new digital money, and any unapproved purchases for things like, verboten gasoline-powered cars or donations to churches that Big Brother brands as racist or terrorist, or even the purchase of a grilled beefsteak, will be blocked in the forced new Green Deal economy. For example, says Sardi, the World Economic Council out of Europe is setting the new great economic reset rules that would limit meat consumption to a once-in-a-while delicacy, unless you're a very good slave, since domesticated animals, I guess not the wild ones, emit methane gas in the form of cow farts that, we're told, contribute to the greenhouse gas effect, which people will soon be praying for, folks, as they realize they've been lied to about non-existent man-made global warming. Steakhouses are obviously going to be a thing of the past, and synthetic Bill Gates burgers would replace the McDonald's Big Mac, regardless of how fake that already is. Disregard the fact that meat is a major source of iron, zinc, vitamins B1 and B12, and cannot easily be replaced by a plant food diet, says Bill Sardi. And a ban on meat would leave fertile young women in a chronic state of anemia, no doubt that's intended to help reduce birth rates, as well as fatigue, and growing children with stunted growth, developmental handicaps, and poor health, as well as the already obviously weakened immune systems. And here he goes to the face mask fraud itself, noting that on March 5th of this year, the Center for Death by Communism and Progressivism released its most recent analysis, sick, of face mask effectiveness, allegedly at least to curb the spread of the booga booga flu and the associated tiny fraction of 1% death rates. Here's the most asinine claim from the report. Quote, mask mandates were associated with statistically significant decreases in county-level daily COVID-19 case and death growth rates. That's the official drivel, says Sardi. The protective effect, if any, though, was only statistical, no more than 2%, not meaningful, and it didn't measure compliance or differences between indoor and outdoor dining, nor adequacy of ventilation, much less, your host notes, did it count the long-term negative health effects that are so obviously associated with a decrease in oxygen and an increase in CO2, not to mention mask knee and gum disease, and all the genuinely nasty diseases that are associated with that. They blew up the charts, he noted, to make changes in death and infection rates of only 1 or 2% look like some mask refusers are mass murderers. Even though, and here he quotes the report in the CDC's own word, quote, allowing, isn't that nice of them, allowing on-premises dining at restaurants was associated with a 0.9%, P equals 0.02, percentage point increase in the case growth rate between 40 and 60 days after restrictions were lifted. Now, here's the key, folks. Sardi notes that this p-value is a measure of statistical significance. Any number inside those parentheses, like that 0.02 there, of less than 0.5, and that's a heck of a lot less, indicates the numbers are statistically significant, better than chance, but still not necessarily meaningful. In other words, these numbers are about as worthless as it gets. And that's not only because of the things that they didn't control for, like compliance and the difference between indoor and outdoor dining or ventilation. In reality, he says, it was only a slight reduction in COVID-19 case and death growth rates when the face muzzle mandates were in force. And any alleged increase after restrictions were lifted is, the way your host would phrase it, nothing but pure BS. COVID-19 infection rates are meaningless anyway, says Sardi, and that's correct, given the extremely high false positive rate, and they only reflect the extent of testing, not the actual true incidence of infection in a population. And they certainly shouldn't be used to destroy an economy and completely undermine the rule of law and what were once called Bill of Rights protections. In other words, the only thing the face muzzles curbed, folks, was human freedom. Forgotten, concludes Sardi, is the fact that people still need to breathe, and wearing a simple dust mask already is known to reduce delivery of oxygen to below OSHA levels. In other words, once upon a time, OSHA would have disallowed anything that's being done to everybody today in a formerly free economy. Isn't it funny you don't hear much about OSHA anymore? Imagine that. As Sardi concludes, and your host has been pointing out since this whole charade began, this is about nothing but control. But the reason I mentioned the obvious again, folks, is because these statistical lies aren't limited to destroying your health. Because after all, when it comes to lying with statistics, it's tough to beat the master, the Bureau of Lying Statistics. And a new piece from Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge today says the CPI jumped in February, but the BLS admitted, though, and this shouldn't surprise us in the least, they're still making most of it up. You have to translate the bureaucraties, but here it is. The BLS just basically admitted it is all BS. Quote, data collection in February was affected by the temporary closing or limited operations of certain types of establishments. These factors resulted in an increase in the number of prices considered temporarily available and imputed. In English, that's not quite as good as a swag, folks, but it might be a teensy bit better than made up out of whole cloth. So, at the very least, says Zero Hedge, take all of the following data with a pinch of salt. And no, there's no conspiracy cover-up here at all to hide the pernicious effects of massive money printing. That would all be crazy talk. And while you're ignoring the fact that the BLS made all of this data up, ignore this chart, too. And the chart that you can't see, folks, shows the so-called UN World Food Price Index, which just basically went from a squiggly line to an almost vertical one. All eyes this morning, though, are on consumer prices, says the piece, as we near the precipice of last year's collapse and the artificial explosion in year-over-year comps that the short-term collapse will create, temporarily, if you're still believing the Fed. Consumer prices in February rose at 0.4% month-over-month. That's the fastest pace since July, lifting the year-over-year price rise to 1.7%, the highest since February 2020. And it's also the ninth straight monthly advance in consumer prices. However, so far as the Fed is concerned, core CPI disappointed, rising only 1.3% year over year instead of the expected 1.4%. Prices for used cars, though, remain a big driver of those changes. And I'll skip over a lot of the rest of the detail here. But it is interesting that the index for airline fares continued to decline in February, falling 5.1% after a 3.2% whack in January. It's down over 25%, though, on an annual basis. Because really, who wants to pay for being treated like meat in a slaughterhouse? Well, if we still had those. From there, we continue to look at lies, damn lies, and CPI statistics with a piece courtesy of Egon von Graert's site, Matterhorn Asset Management at goldswitzerland.com, and Matthew Pippenberg, who says that despite a penchant for doublespeak that would make a politician blush, but certainly not the BLS now, or even the CDC, the Fed tells us their primary focus is unemployment. They're not really worried about inflation. But let's remind readers that an openly nervous Mr. Powell came out in the summer of 2020 with a specific and also headline-making agenda to allow higher inflation above their alleged 2% target. You see, it's not about limiting the peak value, but just the average over some longer period of time. How long? Well, as long as they need to make the numbers come out. All of this amounts to a critical skunk, says Pippenberg in the Fed's semantic woodpile. And it means that the Fed is in sync with the fiction writers at the Bureau of Lying Statistics in a report on consumer inflation that's about as honest as Al Capone reporting his taxable income. In short, the Fed's been lying about and downplaying inflation for years, as John Williams and Shadow Stats have been pointing out for an equally long period of time. He notes, as does Williams, that if you weighted the methodologies hitherto used by the Fed to measure CPI inflation back in the 1980s and used them today, the measured inflation would be closer to 10% than the reported and claimed 2%. And the problem is the following. The Fed is in deep need of keeping its IOU-driven or debt-driven facade of recovery in motion, so they had to invent a respectably controlled, i.e. low, CPI inflation rate in order to make the nobody-really-wants-them-anyway U.S. Treasury bonds look halfway good to somebody who can't print the money to buy them. If real inflation were reported honestly, however, the real yield on those bonds would be, can't have this now, can we? -8%, which will eventually come out and change everything. Among other things, real alternatives, like gold and silver, will have value when paper doesn't, as they will eventually, but it'll take a while before the dumbed-down masses figure that out. Forewarned is forearmed.